tuned to KBOO Portland.
Tune in to Talking Earth, a show dedicated to showcasing our local poetry scene. Join hosts Patrick Picard, Barbara LaMorticella, and Walt Curtis for Talking Earth on the second and third Mondays of each month from 10 to 11 p.m. More information can be found on kboo.fm under schedule.
It is the KBOO Fall Drive, and our theme is The Sounds of Democracy. Everything you hear on KBOO is, in its own way, the sound of democracy, because we are a community radio station. Community radio is one of the most democratic types of media. We're non-commercial and independent. We're supported by our members so that we can keep the airwaves democratic and continue to bring you the valuable voices of your community. Democracy is an experiment, and so is community radio. We're featuring content focused on democracy itself and democratic ideas across the schedule of this drive, and you can support KBOO by donating right now. Go to kboo.fm/give, text KBOO to 44321, or click donate in the KBOO mobile app. Thank you.
Hello, you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, keeping Portland safe and in touch. Community radio has never been more important than here in the time of COVID. KBOO needs your support. You can donate via the KBOO website at kboo.fm/give. There's also a donate button in the mobile app, or you can text KBOO to 44321. That's 44321, text KBOO. But the best way to support KBOO is by becoming a member at kboo.fm/give. KBOO is a nonprofit listener-supported community resource for people like you. This is Wider Window Poetry, and I am your host, Teal Ansari, bringing you voices you may not have heard from places you may not have been. But first, a word about the places where you are. KBOO Portland is located on land that includes traditional village sites of the Multnomah, Wasco, Cowlitz, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Bands of Chinook, Tualatin, Kalapuya, Molalla, and many other tribes who made their homes along the Columbia and Willamette Rivers, creating communities and summer encampments to harvest and use the plentiful natural resources of the area. Portland is home to almost 70,000 people descended from these tribes and others. As a latecomer to this region, descended from slaves and immigrants, I thank the indigenous peoples of the Portland area for this place of refuge. I do have a guest this month, but first I'm going to read a couple of poems by Anthony Walton. Anthony Walton earned a BA from the University of Notre Dame and an MFA from Brown University. He's the author of the poetry volume Cricket Weather and two works of nonfiction, and his short story Slow Burn inspired a screenplay for a film of the same name. He was the co-editor of Every Shut Eye Ain't Sleep, an anthology of poetry by African Americans since 1945, as well as the Vintage Book of African American Poetry. And he's currently the senior writer in residence at Bowdoin College. So I'm going to read two poems by Anthony Walton. And the first one is titled Gwendolyn Brooks. Sometimes I see in my mind's eye a 4 or 5 year old boy, coatless and wandering a windblown and vacant lot or street in Chicago on the windblown south side. He disappears, but stays with me, staring and pronouncing me guilty of an indifference more callous than neglect, condescension as self-pity. Then I see him again at 10 or 15, on the corner, say 47th and Martin Luther King, or in a group of men surrounding a burning barrel off Lawndale, everything surrounding vacant or for sale. Sometimes I trace him on the train to Joliet or Menard, such towns quickly becoming native ground to these boys who seem to be nobody's sons. These boys who are so hard to love, so hard to see except as case studies. Poverty, pain, shame, 1.5 million dreams deemed fit only for the most internal of exiles. That four-year-old wandering the wind tunnels of Robert Taylor of Cabrini Green, wind chill of an as yet unplumbed degree, a young boy she did not have to know to love. And that was Gwendolyn Brooks by Anthony Walton. And the other poem I'm going to read by him is titled Dissidence, and it's dedicated to the memory of Thelonious Monk. Dissidence. You have to be able to hear past the pain, the obvious minor thirds and major sevenths, the merely beautiful ninths. You have to grow deaf to what you imagine are the sounds of loneliness. You have to learn indifference to static and welcome noise like rain, acclimate to another kind of silence. You have to be able to sleep in the city, taxis and trucks careening through your dreams and back again, hearing the whines and sirens and shrieks as music. You must be a mathematician, a magician of algebra, overtone, and acoustics, mapping the splintered intervals of time, tempo, harmony, stalking or slicing blues scales. You have to be unafraid of redundance and aware that dissonance-driven explorations of dissonance may circle back to the crowded room of resolution. You have to disagree with everything except the piano, black and white keys marking the path you must climb step by half step with no compass but the blues, no company but your distrust of the journey, of all that you hear, of arrival. That was Dissidence by Anthony Walton.
KBOO is a nonprofit, listener-supported community resource for people like you. We are one of the oldest community-supported radio stations in the country, and we need your support. You can donate via the KBOO website at kboo.fm/give, but the best way to support KBOO is by becoming a member at kboo.fm/give. Please support the programming you know and love and the radio station that knows and loves you.
And now, my guest this month is Armin Tolentino. Armin is the author of the poetry collection We Meant to Bring It Home Alive. He's been published in numerous journals, including Common Knowledge, Arsenic Lobster, I love that name, Hyphen Magazine, and the Raven Chronicles. He's been a finalist for the Red Hen Press Benjamin Saltman Poetry Award and the Kundiman Poetry Prize, and he received an Oregon Literary Fellowship from Oregon Literary Arts. His poem, Half a Sonnet Stepping in Tomorrow into Tomorrow, is now circulating on C-Tran buses in Vancouver and Portland as part of Artstra's initiative to honor diverse voices in the community through its program Poetry Moves, a collaboration with C-Tran to bring the art of poetry to public spaces. Armin has served with Right Around Portland, the Literary Arts Oregon Book Award Advisory Committee, Friends of William Stafford, has judged for the Oregon Poetry Association, Portland Youth Poets Laureate, Verslandia, and various high school poetry slams, and he's been a mentor for the Apano Asian and Pacific Islander Community Leadership Institute, and currently serves as Poet Laureate of Clark County. Welcome, Armin.
It's wonderful to be here. Thanks so much for having me on. I'd love to start out with a poem of overwhelm. And I've been thinking about overwhelm a lot because if poetry is anything, it must have to connect with emotions. And I'm not always the best at identifying emotions at any given time. So sometimes when I feel a bunch of stuff, I just say I'm overwhelmed. Here's a poem called Another Sunday Usurped, mending tears in a world that can't hold its seams. The space-time crevasse I nicked in the kitchen wall between the air fryer and the soup tureen that's held nothing but shriveled flies splits too far to ignore as the past dribbles through. A trilobite clatters its many chitin feet on the counter, and once again I, a man cursed by hesitation, miss the moment. It scurries before I can scoop it up and plonk it back in the Paleozoic as it becomes, in the present, just one more thing that'll need attending to. I scroll my phone for the fastest fix as I flick a broad spatula at the tear where tentacles and claws of history now pick the edges. On the other side, above the racket of mating pterosaurs, Phoenician wars, and marketplace barter in extirpated tongues, my grandmother pleads, "Abu, let me in. I want to see the future." I brush her off. "Sorry, Lola, this isn't a great time." When what I really mean is, I don't want you to see how I've wasted your dreams for me. When what I mean is, you're another thing tearing on a Sunday that has no daylight left. She's crying, I think, as I duct tape the hole. It's the best I know how to do. The trilobite, long gone, is fast and could be anywhere in the house, cutting whatever it brushes against with its spines, piercing more holes for the past to pour through. More holes through which ancestors peer and discover I never fixed anything long enough to last. Thinking through, what are our choices when we have that experience of overwhelm? There's sort of this idea of like, well, what different thing can I do in that moment? And so this poem maybe is the flip side to that moment of overwhelm, of decision, perhaps. This poem is called Halfway. It's hard to love the things you love for N consecutive days, with N being the number of days you plan to be alive, without so much as a weekend off for your dog-weary heart that also must pump blood and keep your veins from squabbling. For example, the woman who loves swimming so much she freestyled to Cuba, halfway had to be thinking how good the conch fritters were on Duval with lime aioli, what warm and dry once felt like, or how everyone on land is drinking their Hemingway daiquiris at sunset, which sounds so right compared to these jellyfish that have no chill and aim straight for the genitals. It's a fine line between love and hate, said someone who loved me, I think, and was likely first said by another horrible person. Maybe it's a fine line between love and I'm so lost in the riptide of what I thought was all I wanted. At N divided by two, you can say, hell, I'd rather have the fritters, even if I don't know what aioli is. But being halfway, it seems just as easy to go forward as it is to go back, even if in save sacred texts of all sapient languages, the words want and easy have never been directly proportional. So, I've just been thinking there's a lot of reason for us to feel overwhelmed. And a lot of reason for us to want to turn back, even if that isn't really a choice. I'm thinking of how 2 years ago I wrote this next poem, and it's not a poem I wanted to read again, but it just feels so pertinent after seeing photos recently of Haitian refugees and how they're being treated on the border. This is still, a poem that I think I'm building off of and trying to understand what I'm trying to say, but it's called Spikes. And it's named based on having seen many buildings that have spikes on them to keep birds off, and how at one point during the leaders of our country were literally saying we should put spikes on the walls we have on our borders to make it that much more dangerous for people to come to our country. This poem is called Spikes. This nation is filthy with stolen gold and ghosts. Don't you see the garish towers garlanded with spikes to keep the birds that migrate through from resting or making here their home? Someone imagined and someone bankrolled the blueprint for a border designed to metastasize at the emperor's will and annex the world on a whim. What will sate greed? After gold was extracted, ghosts filled the craters. Once a building's walls were border enough. Then we wanted more and fastened spikes to annex a perimeter of sky. Someone imagine the phrase non-lethal deterrence. No blood and no rest for weary magpies. With iron, the empire wrested control of the continent. If you believe the will of the Lord is murder, you first must imagine a way to justify sin, to keep the ghosts and your conscience buried. Say to yourself, the spikes are for their own safety. But the truth is, borders were drawn to trap in cotton and gold. The borders were redrawn to swallow barrels of oil, a restless devouring. Now it's not just buildings. Spikes fixed on branches keep birds from perching on trees. Where will they go? I don't care. I just don't want them here. Ghosts like slag are byproducts of building empires. Imagine the magpie circling the iron plumage of a tree. Imagine how this nation, by design, flexed its borders when we craved feathers or labor or meat. Ghosts are souls refused safe passage. Once water and rest were ancestral rights for all. Now, with willful disregard, we hoard the world for those with gold. We spike rivers with toxins. We gut the earth and fashion spikes and trenches to guard this plunder. Someone imagined and someone made legal this future we bent to our will, where even the birds and the rivers obey our borders. I want to say it wasn't me, but when I'm laid to rest, what I did and didn't do will be for ghosts to judge. Did I dismantle the spikes to build a new border of grapevines? Did I imagine a nation with open palms to the rest of the world? Will I lay alms at the feet of this empire's ghosts? When I think about poetry, I think of it as an art form that allows a lot of obsession, a lot of our imagination, a lot of what captivates us, to have a place to sit and land. And maybe that's not unique just to poetry as an art form. We know Monet painted many water lilies. Clearly he had a thing for water lilies. But I think there is a way with poetry that is unique to other forms of verbal arts, other writing, where you get to keep visiting and revisiting an idea or an image that's stuck in your head and allows you to dive deeper. If there's anything about writing that is of value to me, it's that self-realization for myself and my that better understanding of what I'm thinking through. And I've been thinking through a lot of fishing, because I spend a lot of time fishing, or I spend a lot of time thinking about fishing, or wanting to figure out how to catch a fish, whether I'm good at it or not. And one fish that captivates my attention a lot is this fish called a bullhead. And a bullhead, if you don't fish, is a very small catfish. It's not remarkable looking. Allegedly, it's very easy to catch, even though I am not particularly good at catching them. But it's also not a very loved fish. There's this term that some people use saying trash fish or garbage fish or lesser. And I'm fascinated by that idea of like what makes one living thing so much worse in our eyes than another one. So I circle around this idea of this fish called the bullhead quite a bit. And I'd like to just read a few poems that feature the bullhead. One thing is that they're extremely durable animals, so they can survive in so many situations. And I love the scrappiness of that. This poem is called Midnight Penance. 3 hours out of water, gut hooked and writhing in a bucket, wasn't enough to passively kill the bullhead. I knew just how much life it still had when I dipped the fillet knife behind its adipose fin and dug a swift notch to carve away its back. Quick work usually, but it flinched like its whole body was a single muscle cramped, the hardness of flesh bracing itself against the riptide of stunning pain. And knowing I'd done wrong, I could have pulled the knife from the cut and jammed it instead between the eyes to pike the brain, the mercy of decisiveness. But instead, I kept sawing that wretched back as the fish curled itself into a seizure, and I finished the journey of my mistake at its neck, where I finally leaned my weight down to snap the spine, and the fish went slack. Shoved pliers into the gap, and I pinched the backbone's broken end, so white and conspicuous it was never meant to have wind touch it. And with my thumb in the open gore of a dangling head, pulled apart to release the edible from the waist. But a clutch of eggs spilled forth on the blood-stained cutting board. A pupil dotted each orange sphere, each a north star of its own galaxy extinguished. I was hungry for nothing but sleep, but still I lit a fire to roast the fish without salt and save the black bloodline for last, which I let melt on my tongue like a greasy Eucharist until I recited 5 Hail Marys and swallowed. A few frosted breaths before dawn, I completed this liturgy and buried the spine and the eggs in the garden. Thinking through what this bullhead could be like, I was thinking about the idea of assembly and disassembly. I think that's a fun exercise for any poet, to think about what you build, or how do you describe what you build, and how do you describe what you take apart. So here's my mythology on the building of these bullheads. Apprenticeship under the lesser goddess Hypoxia, who is necessary and unloved and dependent on me because she has no children, to gather the parts of the bullhead. I have traded a decade of youth on this craftsmanship. Crack 3 Gethsemane thorns in August, when their syrupy resin has dried and the points can stick between my teeth, flex without snapping. A measure torn of shipman's rope smoothed by a dozen albatross blizzards, and with my pinky loosen the core of the weave inside, which hollows the body but tightens the skin. For the heart, a too ripe berry with skin so tender, a slanted raindrop could blister it open. This is her act of divinity. She pops the berry inside her mouth and with her tongue pushes it gently into the bullhead's body, smoothing the rope splinters along the way, lest it puncture. In the cold and without air, the juices ferment and come alive. We build them like this by the thousands and release them into bogs, canals, drainage ditches. They know their fate at once and swim away. Neither they nor I give her thanks, ask for her blessings, or ever pause to pray. Bullheads are known for having these spikes on them. Their pectoral fins and their dorsal fins have a sharp spine. So I guess kids who are swimming have to make sure they don't step on them because they could poke them. So otherwise, completely harmless animals. But in this next poem, I think about how they and the idea of fishing really has made me think deeper about my own mental health and my own past with challenges with dealing with my own emotions and dealing with existing in this world. This poem is called A Mascot for Your Mental Illness. Bullhead, harmless and ugly, slime-skinned, stirring the brackish bottom, always stirring the blackest water. You could never tell. Convince yourself it's just the current disturbing your slough. Perhaps, or maybe thousands squirm. When you sleep, the bullhead feeds. When you're awake, just try to spot it cleanly. It shies from direct observation and slithers in any of your hairline fractures. Leave a line out. A bullhead can swallow the trident of a treble hook down to its stomach and still not budge. Sharp things don't startle it. It has taken so many sharp things inside itself and still has blood to spare. It is silent and ugly and harmless, unless, of course, the line is reeled. Drag the dead weight. It cozens with stillness as if it were weeds or lifeless. All it desires to grow and feed in your mud without you ever seeing. Brace yourself for the thrashing if you dare pull its secret to the surface. It'll break its own spine to avoid the light.
So do we think there might be a bullhead chapbook in the works?
I could see definitely this fishing theme and the bullhead being the star of this fishing theme. It deserves its time.
Great. So since you are now the Poet Laureate of Clark County, we're expecting great things from you. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how people are negotiating poetry in this time when we don't have a lot of in-person events, or maybe we're starting to have in-person events again and maybe they're hedged around with different precautions. What's going on? How's that looking in Vancouver?
It's such a humbling experience being able to serve in this role and trying to figure out what poetry can mean for people during such a chaotic and uncertain time. Logistically, it is so difficult to plan out anything. Because when we think of the work of a poet laureate, and when I think about all the great work that my predecessors have done, and what I've seen across the country, really so much of it is that community building. And so how do we find a way to build community when being together is one of the riskier prospects? And so it absolutely has been challenging. I'm grateful to say that we've been able to do a few events live and in person with a lot of safety precautions in place. I was lucky enough to participate in Ridgefield's Multicultural Festival in September. And last week in downtown Vancouver, we got to do an event called Arts Alive, which was a celebration of so many of our performing artists in the community doing music and dance and having poets come out and read. But it is not simple to try to figure out how to reach people in the safest manner, especially when the tools of relationship building for me are really in-person tools. You know, it's really meeting someone for coffee, introducing myself, and trying to find out how I can best support what other people see for poetry. On the flip side, I also see how critical poetry is right now. When I think about how people are experiencing life since February and March 2020, we need as many things in our toolbox, healthy things that can have us get through each day. And poetry is one of the most accessible ones. And I'm hearing that from people of how they're using it to really process everything that they're experiencing now, just to give themselves a space to set their minds right, even if it's just for that moment of writing. So, you know, there's that, there's a complexity of both feeling poetry is as important as ever because of what we're experiencing. And also it does create these real hurdles to providing the community I'd love to see.
You're listening to Wider Window Poetry on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. My guest this month is Armin Tolentino, the Poet Laureate of Clark County. Let's talk a little bit about the craft of poetry. I know many people regard poetry as sort of an inspirational art, and many times when we talk about poetry or we have poetry classes, poetry workshops, they focus a lot on, you know, finding inspiration or releasing inspiration, but there is also the craft of poetry, which I think is important to you as well as to me. Absolutely. So I'd like you to say a few words about the craft of poetry and especially how it relates to the functions of poetry that you just spoke about in this difficult time that we're living in.
Yeah, I'm huge on the idea of craft, and not craft from the perspective of like, oh, this was done right or not, but craft that you as the poet or me as the poet, we did it intentionally. Whatever we did it on purpose. It wasn't an accident, or it wasn't outside of our own presence in the act. So I think of a poem as having a beginning, middle, and end. And how do I know what is the beginning of this poem and what is the middle and what is the end? I think that is a normal thing that we would imagine for a movie. I don't think that would be a weird thing for us to ask of a movie that it have a beginning, middle, and end, or a song. But maybe because of how open poetry can be as far as structure and form, maybe we don't assume it also has those parameters. But it's a thing that exists in this world. A poem is a real living thing that exists in this world, and that means it has some sort of shape to it. And the craft of poetry is saying, what was my intent, and then what is the frame for my intent? So I'm doing this thing on purpose. I'm not forced to write a poem. I'm choosing to do it. And therefore, I must have some sort of intent, which might be that inspiration. It's, you know, we a lot of times think of it as, wow, I saw this really beautiful tree. I saw this beautiful river. I saw this beautiful bird, and I was moved. That's the inspiration. Now what am I going to do with that? And then it has to go to a place of intent. I want to build something of it. You know, you could paint that. You could take out your watercolors and you can paint whatever that was you experienced. or you could write a song about it. Or for those of us who chose poetry, we want to use our words to build out something to recreate or to honor that experience. And we do that for the most beautiful things that have happened to us and the most difficult things. So I think of craft as, first, it's this joy, it's this fun. Like it's enjoyable to write a poem. I don't know why, you know, even when I hate writing poems, I like writing poems. Even when it's horrible writing poems, it's fun writing poems. And you know, I would have stopped a long time ago if I wasn't enjoying it, because there's not many rewards to it, I'll be honest, other than whatever you experience with it yourself in the moment of writing. So craft for me is that opportunity to say, how am I taking that idea of inspiration and then my intent? What am I trying to do now with creating something, this act of art, and how do I do it to the best of my ability? And craft, whether that is, oh, well, here are some very specific forms you can try, or whether you think of craft as what are techniques, metaphor, sonic things like rhyme and meter and alliteration, or syntax. How do I change syntax so it doesn't sound like prose? And creates moments of surprise. All of those are aspects of craft that are fun to play with. And I think any musician, if you talk to a musician, they'd be like, whoa, it was fun seeing what I could do with these different guitar pedals. They would say that. That's what we as poets, I think, could experience too with craft. And so I'm more in that school, Teal, of thinking like, hey, here's a thing where I get to shape it versus I'm the vessel for some sort of voice. And everyone can have their own perspective of how they come to poetry, but I like the idea of building with words and how do I assemble something based on my intent and how close can I make something to what I imagined? That's exciting for me.
And I think that is really reflected in the one of your bullhead poems where you literally imagine building a fish, a living thing, out of these somewhat unlikely ingredients. So what are some resources you would recommend for poets who might want to develop their craft or at least their awareness of craft?
Yeah, there are so many good books out there. So one thing that I think is really useful to just start with is a book on forms. I think it is personally fun to just look at various forms and say, hey, let me try that form. There are so many out there. And I think it's really valuable to see what are indigenous and native forms from your own people's histories. I think it's worth seeing what ways people had assembled language. Knowing that poetry is an ancient art form. So we have ways to look back and see like, oh, well, this is a tradition we've all had and all of our ancestors have had at some point. And it's sort of just neat to see like what is possible with the assemblage of words and how did people think we should structure words. So any book on form, I think, is sort of useful from that perspective. I think beyond like specific craft books, another thing that's really useful is just taking any sort of anthologies of things that you enjoy, find a poem you like and literally write it out. Just write it out with pen and paper, because then it'll give you the experience of figuring out like, whoa, I stopped the line earlier than I imagined I would. It reading it and writing it out, even if it's someone else's words, can give you that experience of thinking where punctuation or line breaks could happen. For specific books on craft, Teal, you and I have talked about this book, Structure and Surprise. And I'm blanking on the name of the author, you might know, but it's an amazing book, I think. It's a collection of essays on what are various structures, not like structures like sonnet per se, or a haiku structure, not that, more the structure of what does a poem do to get you from that beginning, middle, and end? And what is the effect it can create? Because if poetry can do anything, it's that idea of surprise. There are moments that it startles. Poetry isn't built, I don't think, to just be an explanation of things. It's not like reading a car manual that explains you how best to do a thing. It's intended to make you pause and feel an emotional reaction. That can happen when there are these moments of surprise. When we are expecting something and what we get is exactly what we expected when we started a poem, then that usually leads to a place of boredom. It doesn't teach us anything. And if we know what we're going to expect in it, we don't proceed. And therefore, like, considering moments of surprise like you would in fiction, where you think of moments of conflict, I think is critical for a poet.
And the title of that book is Structure and Surprise. The editor is Michael Theune, Theune. And it's subtitled Engaging Poetic Turns. I like that book a lot too.
That's the one. Yes, thank you.
So let's hear a couple more poems if you would, and then I'll have a couple more questions for you.
Would love that. I was grateful for that rain that came recently, but I've been thinking about how dry it has been. I said I would never complain again about a rainy day after what we've experienced in 2021. And then we had this big arts event called Arts Alive in Vancouver, as I was sharing, and it was the day of this gigantic rainstorm. And I was like, hey, I'm not going to complain about it at all. And the rain held off until we were packing up everything, which is really quite cool, and I'm grateful for that. But I'm thinking about how dry it's been, and the forest fires of last year really stuck with me. So here's an autumnal poem. Driest autumn in the driest decade of our reckoning. What left can I expect from our house of straw? The weave so loose. The weevils glut their clicking jaws on our brittle walls of wheat. All night I'm haunted by this anthem of our loss. I barely sleep, no matter how much I tithe to the patron saint of parasites. Your hair is brittle as our house. I scavenged moss and squeezed its moisture on your face to keep your cheeks from caving. Nothing worked. Each breath collapses you more. Woman made husk, mother of chaff. If you remember the well, now choked with brambles, I pulled up buckets and buckets of dusty silver you dropped per prayer. I still can't fathom how much it must cost for even one wish to crawl out and taproot in our salted fields. But still, you gave until your legs gave out. All you earned fed back into the country's maw. I sweep the weevil shells and pour them in the well. I stack the reclaimed silver bits like bricks to build a tarnished mausoleum. This dusk, I propped you up so you could see the horizon, and you and me, we waved and waved to the nothing coming, like stalks with seeded heads so heavy, one good wind will lay us down and scatter us into tomorrow. I've been thinking, you know, again, a lot about that idea of like, what's a poem for? And why are we doing this when there's so many other ways we could be spending our time, our energies, if we even have any energy left? It's perfectly okay to say I have barely any energy to do anything. I was asked to write a poem for sort of like a news spot about the Poet Laureate position. And it's a poem that I want to keep on working on. But I'd like to share this version with you all, even if it's not, it's not done. It's a question I'm going to keep asking myself. The title is a question that comes in and out of my head constantly, and I want to be able to answer it over and over. This poem's called "A Poem's Not Good for Much." Tonight, whatever is due is still due, and whatever's cracked is still cracked, whether you write a poem or not. The debts you owe are still your debts, and the hurtful things hurled at you by strangers or friends still bitter your thoughts. On eastbound 14, someone's driving too fast and will break his mother's heart. And beneath a shady cul-de-sac, a gas line leaks a dozen costly ways, and your regrets are still yours, year after year, burying their taproots ever deeper in your neck. All of this is true, and no poem you write will unload your dishwasher or cure diseases or shield your loved ones from the verbal shrapnel of epithets. But if you pay attention, like the ospreys that cruise Klein Line for a flash of scales that catch the sunset, you can see more clearly each shiny thought swirling in your brain, and you slow the noise of it. You fix nothing with the poem you write, but with your words, you make yourself a map. And so whenever you are lost in this holy and hideous world, you can find yourself again.
So you spoke earlier about obsession, and I think there's clearly an obsession with fish. Even in that poem, there was the image of the fish. Where does that come from, do you think?
The obsession or the fish?
The obsession with fish.
Yeah. It's a great question. Yeah, it makes me think. I had the great privilege when I was studying in at Rutgers to have the poet Tayim Bajest as one of my professors for a semester, and he had just said this offhand comment that sticks with me, where he was just talking about judging a poetry contest, as he was asked to do many, I'm sure, and he said something of like, wow, there's a lot of birds. There's a lot of birds in these poems. And that's, there are certain things that we thematically land on. Birds are one, and I know I have lots of birds and feathers in my poems. And the word bone comes up a lot. As far as fish, I mean, there's a couple things for me. One thing is, it's just an activity I enjoy doing. It's odd where, you know, I grew up fishing with my dad out on, you know, in Jersey and the East Coast. And it's not something I necessarily loved doing as a kid. You know, there would be times where I enjoyed it, but it'd be really boring to me most of the time. And yet I ended up doing it on my own as an adult. And whether you choose to or not, there's a lot of things that as you are raised, they sort of stick with you. Same thing with listening to Steely Dan. I don't know why I'm listening to Steely Dan, but I just listen to Steely Dan constantly. There's something about maybe because my dad listened to Steely Dan. Or watching boxing, you know, as a kid, I didn't necessarily love watching boxing. I didn't understand it as a sport. And now, you know, I it's something that maybe part of it is to stay connected with my dad, you know, who is very far away and still back in Jersey. And, you know, it's one of the few things that we do openly talk about, because conversation with us is very, very stilted otherwise. But there's something about when you enjoy doing something and the vocabulary that comes from it. It's so much fun when you're into a certain thing to now start delving into the language of that thing. I know a poet who was really into ping pong. And so her being able to write these ping pong related poems because of that, this other poet who told me she didn't like basketball at all, but then her kids started playing basketball. And then how she was just obsessed with the vocabulary of it and the sound of it. And that's what I think poetry allows us to do, take these things that we're just sort of interested in and diving into it. But beyond that, I think it's reciprocal for me. So yes, I do like fishing and spending time fishing. And again, people reach out to me. If you know places that we should go fishing, you know, I'll pick up the bait. You just tell me where we should go. But the idea of also as a poet, I love thinking about these opportunities for metaphor. And when I started writing fishing related poems, which I felt was almost 10 years ago at this point, they were really more based on a question of racial identity. That was really where I was starting, because I was thinking a lot about how fishing on the West Coast and in Oregon and Washington, what fishes were valued or not valued, and the territorial nature of who gets to be on the river or not. I found all of that really fascinating to me, and how it looked different from how I was fishing or how I knew how to fish out on the East Coast. But then the question of fishing or the exploration of it through poetry really started going deeper into mental health. There were too many metaphors I couldn't ignore. This idea of being hooked, this idea of a very thin line connecting things and the tenuousness of that. It was just something I kept having to dive into and deeper and deeper. And it's still something I'm working on. That's where, like, I feel like I'll have that chapbook, or I'll have maybe even a full length something when I really get to the heart of what I'm trying to say. And so that, again, is that idea of that intent. I have this intent of what is it about fishing and the metaphors of fishing and the anatomy of fish that fascinates me, that I want to keep diving into. And then where can I use the craft and my hopefully getting better and building as a poet, where I can learn how to shape words to convey something about this that obsesses me, that a reader can also read and be like, wow, I experienced what he was experiencing, or I had a new experience based on what he created. That's my hope for it.
So tell us something about your work with Apano and the Asian Pacific Islander Community Leadership Institute specifically. What do they do?
Yeah, it's a program that I think has been on hiatus the last couple of years. But, you know, I was really just honored to be able to participate. It's a mentorship program to build our community leaders. And I had the opportunity to work with a young man where we would gather once a month and talk just about all sorts of things. Yes, professional things. You know, I was able to share, you know, some of my professional journey and some of the things I do and opportunities around that. But we also got to talk about our passions. We were both into writing in different ways. We both love basketball. He was a Blazers fan, though. I'm a Knicks fan. So, you know, it's not like we were completely aligned. But that's okay. There's space for all of us in this world. But I just, it was just such a great experience to see how Apano really tries to build community in these really robust ways. You know, it wasn't just a matter of trading phone numbers with people, or here's my business card, call me at some point. It was this opportunity for mentors and mentees to sit and process through ideas, think about plans, all those mentees worked with each other in different ways as well. I'm excited to hear how Apano follows along with those folks, because it's not a matter of just a one and done year kind of program. I know that they have stayed in touch with all the leaders that came out of this program, and it'll be exciting to see how those young folks in our community have really stepped up during this difficult time.
You're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. This is Wider Window Poetry. My guest is Armin Tolentino. So I think we have time for one more poem, and then I would like to ask you a completely random question.
Oh, I can't wait. Let me finish with this poem. You've heard this one, Teal. The title is a word in Tagalog, one of the languages of the Philippines that means inheritance. It's called Bamana. I need to wash my worries. I have to fold my worries. I need to sort and store my worries where I can have them at the ready, where I can find when I need it most the worry that matches the moment. I have to mend the worries I've had so long they've worn through to gauze. I patch worries with old worries. I refuse to throw any away. Most I don't even know how I got. Most I am certain draped my mother's shoulders first. My cherished ones were sewn by the fingers of my ancestors who had nothing else to leave their children for inheritance. I need to care for my worries. I'm filled with peace when I wrap my arms around a freshly cleaned heap of my worries and string them on a length of mourning to dry. One glittering moment that I am naked of worries. I love to see them breathe in the sun.
Great. So here is your random question. If you could talk to one person from history, who would you choose and why?
One person from history. Oof, that is there are so many people just out of curiosity or that I could learn from in these spaces. I guess you know, TL, I love paleontology. So talking to either, you know, Dr. Marsh or Cope, you know, paleontologists from the 1800s, just to find out what that was like to discover, like, it still boggles my mind to realize there was a point where we were just learning that there were all these creatures that lived in this world before we were here. And to have that awareness and what the realization would have been in that moment. I don't think either of those gentlemen were particularly nice or lovely human beings. They sound pretty cutthroat and awful. They were sort of mercenaries of trying to beat each other in a scientific field to say, like, well, who found the most new fossils or most new species? So they might not be the most pleasant people to talk to, but I am curious what their perspective would be on, like, well, what is that like? What do you think this means to find this thing in the ground, this thing that doesn't exist now? What does that mean for your own sense of self and for humanity? I think I'd like to talk to someone like that because to have that awareness that we don't have to centralize humans in every conversation. This world and this universe is big and has existed a long time. And I don't mean that to say that I don't love human beings or want us to thrive and persevere and survive for a long time. But to imagine that there was a world before us and there will be a world without us. And what is it for a human being to pause and think about a world that is beyond themselves? It's an exercise I want to do for myself individually. I think it's a good exercise for us as a species to do. And so I think I would want to talk to either of those gentlemen and then also find out what their favorite dinosaur was. I'd be curious about that too.
Thank you, Armin. This is Wider Window Poetry on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. My guest this month was Armin Tolentino. Stay safe out there, and we'll talk to you again next month. Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, Community Radio.
Community radio is a democratic type of media, but what does that mean? This fall drive, KBOO is examining what